Texans now.
The levels of obesity are highly correlated with the conditions in people's lives.
Right now, we have about 40,000 people per year who die of gun violence, and we need to do everything we can to lower that number.
Hi there, WAMC News Director Ian Pickus here. On this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, New York State weighs public campaign financing. A new report tracks youth obesity rates in the Northeast, and we speak with a Skidmore College graduate who lost a daughter in the Parkland, Florida school shooting. New York State's Public Campaign Finance Commission met for several hours on Columbus Day to discuss the nuts and bolts of how to implement a matching public donor system for statewide races. Capital correspondent Karen DeWitt reports.
The commission spent several hours discussing how to implement a matching small donor public campaign finance system for statewide races. They reached consensus on a few issues that give an indication of how the final proposal due in December might look. They discussed contributions beginning at $5 and up to $250 could be matched by the public fund at a 6-to-1 ratio. A candidate for governor who opts into the system could receive up to $18 million in matching funds, $8 million for a primary and $10 million for a general election. That number is lower than the $30 million spent by Governor Andrew Cuomo, who was the winning candidate in 2018. The commissioners also discussed a $4 million cap for matching funds for candidates for attorney general and controller. Senate and assembly seats might be limited to matching funds of $750,000 per candidate. Commissioners said contributions to political parties might continue to be unlimited, though. The commission is also powerless to regulate independent expenditures or super PACs. That's due to Supreme Court decisions limiting regulation of independent expenditures. Commissioner Henry Berger, an election law attorney appointed by Governor Andrew Cuomo and the leaders of the legislature, says the aim is to set the amounts high enough to attract only serious candidates, but not make it so difficult as to discourage legitimate candidates.
What we're creating is meant, among other things, to change behavior. We want people going out and seeking the smaller contributions.
That's the whole point.
And we want them seeking them within their district.
Before the meeting, advocates for public campaign financing demonstrated outside.
Fair elections! Now!
The commission has also discussed whether to end the practice of fusion voting in New York. That allows candidates to be cross-endorsed by third parties and run on multiple ballot lines. Assemblyman David Buchwald says the commission should not be deciding the future of fusion voting and should stick to the commission's original purpose.
The fact that they've been more focused on banning fusion voting in New York shows that so far there's no indication that their heart is really in this endeavor that they've been passing.
The topic of fusion voting was not mentioned at the public meeting. Commissioners will meet to try to hash out more details in mid-November. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Well, a new report says more than 250,000 New York residents aged 10 to 17 are obese. WAMC's Capital Region Bureau Chief Dave Lucas has more.
The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation report, State of Childhood Obesity, Helping All Children Grow Up Healthy, finds that the New York State obesity rate stands at 14.4% in young people ages 10 to 17. Caitlin O'Brien, Government Relations Director of the American Heart Association in New York State, finds the survey results disturbing.
This is information found in the National Survey of Children's Health. And what we see is that there's an alarming epidemic of childhood obesity in the state of New York. About 267,000 people, a little bit more than that, 8 kids, essentially, ages 10 through 17, have obesity. And this is really alarming when you think about it, because what we're seeing is kids who are being set up for a lifetime of suffering from chronic diseases. We know that childhood obesity increases your risks of heart disease and stroke, which are the nation's number one and number five causes of mortality nationwide. It also increases your risks of diabetes, certain cancers. So it's really something that we know we have a problem with, and now it's time for the state to take action.
The report raises concerns about disparities in obesity rates related to race and income. Black and Hispanic youth had obesity rates of 22.2% and 19%, respectively, about double that of white youth, 11.8%, with Asian youth less likely to be obese at 7.3%. Executive Director Kevin Jobin-Davis says a Healthy Capital District Initiative survey found local disparities.
38% of black non-Hispanics are obese versus 28% of white non-Hispanics. To a lesser degree, low-income residents of the region are more obese, with about 3% more residents earning below $25,000 a year being obese.
An earlier survey funded by the Johnson Foundation found New York State's obesity problem affects people of all ages. John Auerbach is president and CEO of Trust for America's Health.
What we've learned is that the levels of obesity are highly correlated with the conditions in people's lives. Schools in lower-income neighborhoods are often less likely to have the nutritional options that schools in well-resourced communities have.
O'Brien says there are several ways agencies and governments can help people at the community level improve their overall health.
Improving school wellness policies throughout the state, so supporting the Healthy Hungry Free Kids Act and help school districts implement better and stronger school nutrition policies that include physical education, physical activity, school marketing programs. All of that can really go a long way in teaching kids how to be healthy at a young age and really helping fight off childhood obesity.
Connecticut has the 8th lowest obesity rate for youth ages 10 to 17, Vermont the 13th lowest, and Massachusetts 4th lowest. There are links to the reports at WAMC.org. Dave Lucas, WAMC News.
Fred Guttenberg, a 1988 graduate of Skidmore College, is returning to his alma mater this week, but the trip from Florida to the campus in Saratoga Springs will not be one for reunions and college memories. Guttenberg will speak Wednesday night at the school's Gannett Auditorium about gun violence. His 14-year-old daughter, Jamie, was killed during the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, in 2018. Guttenberg spoke with WAMC's Brian Shields.
I attended a vigil in Parkland for the community, and the mayor asked if I would speak when I got there. And, you know, because I wasn't expecting that, I hadn't prepared, and I just went up there and let it rip. And it set me on this path that continued about a week later at the CNN town hall, where I confronted Senator Rubio, and I haven't stopped. I have been traveling this country, going state to state, meeting with state assemblies. In fact, I'll be meeting with Governor Cuomo and his administration the day after Skidmore. I've been in D.C. a lot and working on changing the gun laws in this country, working on getting out the vote, working on helping people across America try to understand what it means to be a victim of gun violence and why it's incumbent upon them to take this mission seriously or they could be next. And so this has been my life. You know, I spend my life now honoring my daughter's memory and fighting for the reason to change the reason that led to her no longer being with us.
What is some of the gun legislation you would like to see?
Well, number one, let's start with background checks. The simplest, easiest thing that everyone should be able to agree on. We currently have legislation that has passed the House. It should pass the Senate, but they won't take it up for a vote. Background checks should also be extended to ammunition, because if you're a prohibited purchaser of firearms, by law, you're also prohibited from buying ammunition, but there's no requirement today for a background check on ammunition. So people can get guns through private transfer, illegally stealing them, whatever, and walk into the store to buy the bullets. And I'm trying to stop that. So I've been working across the country to pass Jamie's Law, which seeks to extend background checks to ammunition. We ought to be raising the age 21. We ought to be banning high-capacity magazines. We ought to be allowing the issue of gun violence to be studied as a public health crisis. We need to repeal PLACA, which is a federal law that makes it illegal for people like me to pursue litigation against those that are responsible, the gun manufacturers, for flooding our streets with these weapons. There's a whole variety of common sense things that we can do, none of which is an alienation to anybody's Second Amendment right, none of which takes away anybody's, who is a legal, lawful gun owner, who takes away their rights to have weapons. However, red flag laws or extreme risk protection orders, if you are a known threat to someone, to yourself or someone else, you ought to lose your weapons. And so that would be the final piece of what I would say in terms of what I consider crucial towards saving lives.
What is the mental health component of this? There are very often these shooters give warnings of some sort, their behavior, perhaps threats verbally or otherwise, and the red flag law is meant to address that kind of situation.
Well,
but other than that, how do you stop these things before they happen when someone perhaps is giving warning signs?
Well, number one, people don't always give warning signs. However, when they do, we do need to take those seriously. And that's where red flag laws or extreme risk protection orders become crucial. With regards to mental health, they're more often the violence is more often committed on them than committed by them. And I think we have a situation in this country where a lot who don't want to do anything about the issue of access to guns will go out and scream mental health to avoid doing anything about guns and to just kind of, throw the shiny object down the road somewhere. Listen, we do need to deal with the reality of gun violence in this country. Part of dealing with that is better access to mental health care for those who are suffering, and also for those who have a history, ensuring that they don't have access to weapons. You know, one of the first things this current president did is actually loosen up the restrictions that were already in place, preventing the mentally ill from getting access to weapons. We need to tighten that back up. So there's so much that can be done, common sense, that would never, ever, ever infringe on the rights of a legal, lawful gun owner. And we need to do it. Because right now we have about 40,000 people per year who die of gun violence, and we need to do everything we can to lower that number.
Well, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Stay subscribed for the latest from the Northeast. And until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.